You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome to Victory Points. I'm Becca Scott.
And I'm Jake Michaels.
This is a podcast about people who love tabletop games, interviewing other people who love tabletop games about the tabletop games they love.
If someone's listening to this on double speed,
they're wrong to do so because I talk very quickly. This week, our guest is Jeff Cannata. Ooh. Lover of cans. Jeff is everywhere and does everything. You may know him from the extremely popular tech-based web talk show, The Totally Rad Show, once praised by Wired Magazine as the best weekly video podcast, period.
It was a long time ago.
There were fewer
of them then.
Whatever. Wired doesn't say things that can be retroactively
wrong.
No take backsies, Wired. You may also know him from his many performances as different types of dads and law enforcement on popular TV shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dads or cops or cop dads.
Cop dads.
That's what I play.
And as a correspondent on several shows on the former network G4, and his podcast, DLC, the video game podcast, and /filmcast, and most recently he has become the DM for the interactive live RPG show, The Dungeon Run, on the social broadcasting platform, Caffeine. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you. Also on YouTube and as an audio podcast, yeah. Thank
Ooh,
you.
Yeah. All the places, all the things.
All the places, yeah.
Oh my gosh, where to even start? Okay, well, we should say what we're going to talk about.
Board games, I hope. I'm a lover of board games, so this fits perfectly.
We will talk about board games, sure. And I'm very glad you are a lover of board games. We also end up talking more often than not about Dungeons and Dragons because
yeah.
Every
Yay!
Guest also plays D&D, and that's all they want to talk about. But we're going to talk about the idea of the Magic Circle, which was new to me, not as a concept, but a concept with a name. So we'll get to what the Magic Circle even is. But it is magic and it is a circle. That's all we can tell you so far. We're also going to talk about one of my favorite games from the past couple years, Decrypto.
Yeah, so good.
So excited. And then we'll talk about a couple games. One you recently played, one that's an all-time fave.
Mm-hmm.
So the all-time fave is Le Havre mm-hmm. by Uwe Rosenberg.
Well said.
Very prolific. And Everdale.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a fun little game. Very yeah. cute worker placement. So that's what we'll get to. But first, how'd you get your start doing all the cool stuff that you do?
Yeah. Well, I started out as a child.
Go on.
How far back to go? When I was 14, in like fifth grade or sixth grade, wherever you are in that age, I wrote a...
I believe that's seventh grade.
Seventh grade? Is it? Maybe... Yeah. Whatever. Anyway, somewhere around there, I entered into a contest at school. We wrote short stories. We had to write them. There was assignment. We had to write them. And all of those short stories were entered into a contest. And I happened to win that contest.
What?
Yes. Yeah, like the grand prize, like the big like Pan County prize.
Do anyway. You have the story on you? Can you read it?
No, but it is a fantasy story. It's funny how like even back then I was like, you know, wanting to make fantasy stories.
You knew.
They sent a reporter out to the house and to like do a local kid makes good thing. And my dad was like, hey, you know, you wrote the story. Maybe you're good at writing. Would you want to be a writer? And I was like, I don't know. And he said, well, what would you want to write if you wrote stuff? And I said, well, I would want to write about video games. And because I was reading a magazine at the time called Computer Gaming World.
Yeah. I subscribed.
There was a writer in that named Scorpia, who I thought was cool. And I don't even know who she was, but. She wrote under the nom de plume, Scorpia. Anyway, and so I was like, yeah, I want to write video game reviews. He's like, okay. And so when this reporter came to the house to like do this local kid makes good story, they're like, my dad would said, hey, would your newspaper ever be open to having a kid review video games? And
your
they're like,
dad is so sweet.
I don't know. Write up a few samples and we'll see. And that led to like 4 years of me writing video game reviews for the newspaper.
What?
It was my first job. My first job
What newspaper was this?
The Contra Costa Times, Northern California.
I'm a subscriber.
You're a subscriber. I don't even know. We have to explain what newspapers are to a large portion of the listeners.
Wait, start from square one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so that's my origin
what
story.
What an
that's
amazing
like,
father,
so cool.
too. Like, to like instigate that so with such force. That's great.
You know, and this will only make sense to you, but in that original story, I haven't told anybody this, by the way. In that original story, which is a fantasy story, the character goes to a place called Deep Reef, which is where we're going in Dungeon
it
Run.
It stayed
Give
with you.
Give us the rundown, Jake.
It's the location of something dark and treacherous that we're going to see in future episodes.
Yeah, it's a, I put it in. I like put it in the world that we're making on Dungeon Run. The
That's so D&D great.
World. So yeah, it's like a little throwback to my my own little origin story.
Yeah, it's great so to go back into the bin from of history and like pull some of those names out for sure.
Yeah,
I still do that.
Did you remember that name, or did you reread your story?
No, I haven't. I haven't read the story in many years. I'm sure it is not great, but I did remember. I remember the moment as a kid of coming up with fun fantasy names, and still my favorite thing about being a DM is coming up with the names of stuff.
You're quite good at that.
Well, I appreciate you saying that.
That's one of my tough things because, like, whenever I pepper in NPCs, everybody's like, "Okay, what's your name?" I'm like, Juan Malin. Now I gotta commit to that.
Yeah. I spend a disproportionate amount of time coming up with the names of people and things.
Yeah, you have a lot of people ready. I see you looking at your notes. I'm like, he has like a laundry list of people. He's got a phone book over there.
Can I have some examples of good? How do you make a good name for an NPC?
I think everybody has a different metric, I'm sure, but for me it has to have like a rhythm to it. It has to sound good coming out of your mouth, you know.
You have to hit the syllables right.
Yeah,
alliteration.
Yeah. like there's a character that has been in Dungeon Run already that is the mentor of one of our player characters, and his name is Hermel Fesh. I just think
Hermel Fesh,
right? Mm-hmm. Like sounds like an
Sounds like a
mentor.
Star Wars character,
a little bit, yeah,
and is memorable. Like,
I mean,
Boba Fett.
I think Star Wars is the prime example of character names that sound good.
Very true. They made numbers sound good.
Yeah. Binks.
Well, you picked the one.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah, okay.
You picked the one that doesn't really fit. But you know, like Han Solo sounds good.
Darth Maul.
Jabba the Hutt. You know that they
Boba Fett.
Yeah.
I just love the prequels.
Yeah, clearly.
But like I say, they made letter and number combinations work. Like, we all know R2-D2. That flows so nicely.
C-3PO just sounds good coming out of your
mouth. And actually, in the books, I remember for a long time, they wrote out R2.
Right.
Like, A-R-T-O-O was how he was written.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was interesting because I still would read it the same way.
R2. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, those work because they don't sound like numbers first.
They sound like normal word sounds.
Yeah. C-3PO. Yes.
So I'm a sucker for that stuff, and you know, like I like puns and wordplay.
Yeah, you do.
I'm a language lover, so I get off on that stuff.
Yeah. Well, I watched the very cool intro to episode one.
Oh, cool.
There's like a squid man sitting on a throne.
Squid man.
Technically, he's an illithid.
You know what a mind flayer is?
Illithid, yeah, illithid. Yeah, he's a mind flayer.
Right.
You're
I knew
a
that.
Fan of the dark ones.
He's our host. We have an animatronic puppet that hosts the show, kind of like the old Crypt Keeper from Tales of the Crypt, if you remember that show.
Yeah.
That's insane. How did you get an animatronic puppet?
From the animatronic puppet district. You know, down in it's
over by Pasadena.
Don't go there late at night. That's dangerous. They will solicit
it's
you.
Creepy. Yeah, as hell.
Do you remember the first game you ever GM'd?
I don't. I probably could narrow it down to the people that were there, but I don't remember exactly what game it was. I think the first time I DM'd was probably because no one else was willing to do it, you know, and they knew I would do the work, you know. That's how it tends to be. It's like everybody gets to show up, but one person has to prepare.
Yeah.
And has come to do up the with homework. A lot of great NPC names.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I want to know about this magic circle you've mentioned.
Well, this is not an idea that I invented. In fact, it was, I wish I could remember the author of the book. This is from the 18-somethings. But it is an idea that was introduced to me on a podcast I really enjoy called Ludology, which is a podcast formerly hosted by Jeff Engelstein, who's a friend, but also a very awesome board game designer. He's designed a whole bunch of games that I'm sure you've played. He on an episode, they focused on this concept of the magic circle, and it really stuck with me. The idea being that the magic circle is the name for an idea, a concept that we all enter into when we agree to play.
Social contract.
Social contract.
That you
Excellent
sign with
way
blood.
To describe it. Yes. Signed with blood. Well, maybe you play differently than I do.
Okay.
She does. We sit down to play. We all agree that we're going to play by the rules. And just that agreement sets aside the normal rules of the world. Mm-hmm. So while you're in the magic circle, the normal things that happen in the world get paused. And we're in this place where we both agree that we're going to try to win, or we both agree that we're going to cooperate to try to win, or we both agree, you know, that we're going to try to get this basketball into this hoop, right? Magic circle exists in sports. It exists anytime that you
anywhere agree. Except politics.
Well, yeah, there doesn't seem to be any
no,
rules
we
there.
We don't have to go there.
But the idea being that that's what's special about play is that we all agree that for this to work, for us to have fun and do this endeavor called play, we all have to agree to a set of rules. And in doing so, we are actually creating something that relies on trust and relies and it is a magical thing that sets aside the world's normal boundaries and lets us be in a place that we decide. And I find that really intoxicating. It's something that I talked to all the players of Dungeon Run before we started doing the show that I find sacred. Like it's a really beautiful notion that when we sit down to play any board game, that you and I and all the players are now, we're trusting each other on a level that you don't normally do in life. And we are agreeing to something tacitly, but we are agreeing to something that is special and unique. And I think that's what's so wonderful about sitting down on a table and playing a game is that you create this magic circle and you exist in it, and it is different than the real world.
Oh, so beautifully said. Absolutely. I mean, I think that's what we all love about it. Question.
Answer.
Is it a violation of the magic circle to hold a grudge after a game is over because of something that happened within the magic circle, a betrayal perhaps, that you carry on?
Well, the wonderful thing about the magic circle is that it isn't one thing. It depends on your players and your friends and the rules that you are all agreeing to tacitly. Like if I play what's the
Dungeons and Dragons?
Well, what's the famous diplomacy? If I play diplomacy, right? If I play diplomacy, part of the agreement that we're getting into is that it can get nasty.
We're gonna backstab each
and
other.
And maybe the last game of diplomacy we played, I'm gonna bring into this game of diplomacy, and I'm gonna remember how you backstabbed me and reneged on your deal and all that stuff. So each time we create a new magic circle, the rules can be a little different. I think in general, holding grudges is not super positive, but
bad for the
sometimes
soul.
That can be fun. Sometimes that can be the fun. Sometimes playing a legacy game or, you know, playing a series of games of Risk, you know, Risk Legacy, or even just regular Risk without any, but you bring the fact that last time you beat all my armies, so this time I'm going to take it to you. Well, I think that's going to be fun too.
Is it almost like actually you kind of have two relationships with a person, whereas like I would have a relationship with Becca at the table, like in terms of our relationship with Twilight Imperium and how much we really are antagonists, but then we're
Except
close friends in real life.
I always trust you. I always trust you.
But then when we go back into that circle and play again, we're going to take that context from the last circle. So we're really returning to the same kind of one. You're right. The rules have changed a little bit because there's other people there or the game might be different. But yeah, that's interesting. It's like it's also a relationship change in terms of how you treat those people. Someone you might dislike in real life might be teamed up with you on your side for a team.
Yes.
And you're like, okay,
here we go.
That's happened
before. How cool
before.
Is that? And like,
that is great.
The idea that we are a team in this game where the result of it matters absolutely zero.
Yeah, it's not important.
But we'll create a completely different dynamic between us.
We will work with each other, which we wouldn't have outside of this circle.
Right.
Yes.
So to bring it back to politics, if we get Mitch McConnell and Elizabeth Warren to play a board game.
I like it.
do we have an opportunity to kill Mitch McConnell? In the magic circle, yeah, yeah. In the context of the magic circle, that's where I was going.
I think if I had to say what board game they are playing right now, the first one that comes to my head isn't diplomacy. It's cash and guns.
Well said. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
It's just a game of chicken.
Grab and go. Yeah. Oh.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well,
for sure.
But when you don't care about anything, chicken is a lot easier for your side.
I will say that specific example is going to be a tough one to circle the square. But I will say that, yeah, I think it can bring people together in some way. I don't think it solves problems, but it lets people relate, right? Getting into that circle, you see a person in a different way.
Absolutely. Well, I think you can also see people's truest nature.
Oftentimes, yeah. Yeah.
And that's
in a good and bad way.
I've become a better person through playing games and realizing who I was in a game a couple years ago versus who I am in a game now. And my goals have changed because I realized that winning isn't everything. Winning can make your friends mad at you.
Well, yeah. I mean, I love board games. I love them. And I'm always trying to win. My joy as to the experience of playing that game bears very little relevance to whether I win or lose. I'm there to win because that's the goal. That's the agreement we all made when we sat down, is that we're all going to try to win. But, you know, that's not where the fun lies for me.
Yeah, I feel like insecurities drop within the circle, generally speaking. That's not always globally true, but people tend to, like you said, you see their honest self. It's because they're not on guard as much because they feel like, oh, we're just playing this game that doesn't have as much of a consequence. And our relationships have changed because of it. And we're not thinking about all that outside stuff.
Absolutely. And I'm sure you guys have had the experience, I certainly have, of somebody isn't in the same circle as everybody else. You know, one person sitting at the table hasn't processed all the rules that we're all playing by, the tacit agreement that we all made, and it can be uncomfortable and weird, and you're like, oh, that person
is on their phone.
Is on their phone or whatever it is. Or, you know, is just treating the experience in a different way than everybody else agreed to. And it isn't something that's explicit, right? It's something that we came to, we all felt, and that person somehow didn't. And that's when you really feel that circle is not completely closed, right?
Yes, I wanted to put a label on that that you just named with a cell phone, which is presence, the issue of presence, right. And that's a big part of the agreement. And part of why I think we love to play games is because, well, right now there's a computer in front of me that I keep looking at instead of looking at you, but if we were playing a board game, I couldn't do that.
right. Yeah.
It's an issue of respect and giving your full time and your full presence to the other people, which is so beautiful and not done enough.
I think you're right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's kind of what I love about analog entertainment is that it's slower, it's more present, and there are those distractions and temptations, but you know, it's different than the other.
There's something also about the tactile nature of it.
Yes.
Like, I don't know why, maybe it's our monkey brains a little bit, but like putting pieces together and moving stuff around and seeing what you have visually in that way.
I mean, one of my favorite things in the world to do is punch out a new board game. I don't know why. That should be a laborious, not fun thing to do, but I like putting them in little baggies and figuring out how it's going to fit in the box.
One of the greatest pleasures in life.
And some of the best Christmas gifts I've ever gotten were box organizers, those companies that sell those amazing box organizers.
Yes.
It's like, I don't know, that shouldn't be a good gift, but it's amazing.
I would say a game gets played more in my house if it's well boxed.
I like that.
The beauty of a well boxed game. You know, I think the punching thing. One of my favorite movies is Amelie, this French film.
Oh, I know it.
And there's a scene where she talks about simple pleasures and lists her favorite pleasures. And one of them is digging her fingers into a giant barrel of coffee beans or a different type of beans.
Sure.
And just that image of that's what it is. That's what punching out cardboard is.
That's such a great example, too, because when you say that, I can feel the sense memory in my hand of what that feels like. That's such a distinct thing.
Ooh, yes.
Let's just do an ASMR episode. Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Well, next
pouring
episode.
Beans over the microphone.
Bonus ep. Speaking of the temptation of other things, a quick word, and we'll be right back with more Jeff Cannata.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Welcome back to Victory Points. We're here with Jeff Cannata from all the things on the internet. Most recently, the Dungeon Run on Caffeine and YouTube and all the places.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get into some games we like.
Okay. Because
we like, this is a show about board games. Yeah. So we should talk about board games.
Okay.
Okay. So I want to talk about Decrypto.
Yes.
All right. If I may, I would like to describe how this game is played for people who have never played. This is a game in which there's two teams, and each team has four words in front of them that only their team can see. Then players, one on either team, will rotate, being the clue giver for their team. They're going to grab a old floppy disk card, which has a code on it, and that code is a series of three numbers that correspond to three out of those four words their team is looking at. So it'll say 431, 213, 314, area code. Anyway, then the clue giver is going to give three code words or code phrases aloud to everyone. Even the other team will hear them,
right,
associated to the three of the four words in front of them in the order that their secret code is written in. And the goal is both teams are going to try and guess what three numbers are on that card they drew, that the clue giver drew. And the first team to either successfully guess the opponent's code twice, or the first team to will win if you do that, or the first team that mistakenly guesses their own team's codes wrong twice will lose. Yeah.
Wow. So the thing that's amazing about this game is that it evolves as you play it with the same team. At least that's been my experience.
The meta, right? Oh,
yeah. Because you start realizing that the trick to playing this game is creating clues that clue your team into something because they have more information than the opposite team, but throw the other team off the scent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you start having these very layered clues where you're purposely saying words that can have two meanings, and you're hoping your team picks up on the correct meaning and the other team picks up on the wrong meaning. And it is, if you play with the same group of people over the course of a few hours and you play the game a few times, it gets real good. Because you start realizing what they pick up on and you go, okay, I'm going to purposely mess up. We're going to throw in a complete non sequitur just to screw with them so that they don't think that we're on the,
you
know, on the right.
You guys can plan that?
Well, no, you have to do it singly, right?
Just like code names,
you're
right?
You're hoping your team picks up on it,
oh
but your
God.
Team knows because we've been playing a while that that's kind of what we've been doing.
You've got that
so they're like, okay, I see what you're – it is awesome.
You
so want to
know my
fun.
Favorite little cheat, little hack? I will do a complete song lyric where only one of the words in the song lyric corresponds to one of my team's words, and my team – hopefully somebody figures out which word I was
<That's> awesome.
Focusing on.
Yeah. I mean, it's so fun to try to guess what the other team is doing, too. And your team can talk and be like, I think they're talking about this or that, but no. And then you're trying to guess the words before you even revealed them. I love this game. I think it is super simple. And you can play it on a very, you know, simple level. But as you learn it, as you keep playing it, it's simple to learn, but the strategy becomes more and more complex as you develop this wonderful relationship with your team and the other team, and you kind of get what's happening. Oh, man. We had so much fun.
Yeah, because you have...
It's funny that you said you have had a night where you played a couple times. I think the first time I played it, maybe 20 minutes. Every other time since then, 3 hours of laboriously coming up. Like, one person goes in the other room, shut up, don't talk to me, I have to think. I need this to that level. But then the other team will guess that because they know. Because you have to, for each word, you have to think of four different meanings. And then never, ever once, like, overlap meaning of a word, or else the other team will be able to guess because they're
You want to have the word add up to the word that's wrong because you want to screw the other team. So you're like, yes, that word can lead them down the wrong path to the wrong word. So that's good. But now I have to make sure my team doesn't go down that path too. Yeah. It's
also
great.
Oh, yeah. They know they're being deceived, right? That's the triple blind is like, "Oh, wait." Right. They're on guard
for
this.
But was it too easy?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
Maybe that's how they get you, cuz you overestimate them, but don't overestimate people in this game. That's what I found.
I find that the same types of things emerge when you play Codenames a lot with the same group of people, too. You sort of understand a shorthand, and you have these strategies that happen. But I think this game is that on a completely new level. I think it really, the complexity because of how you can steal other teams' points and stuff, it's really clever.
I would say Decrypto is a game for the group of gamers that have played Codenames 1,000 times.
Yeah.
And need the next level.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
That's a great way to describe it.
How many people can play it?
Infinite.
It's true. The bigger the group, the more fun it can be. In fact, I haven't played it with small groups, but I would suspect that small groups is not as fun as like 5-6 people per team. Mm-hmm. I think that can be way fun.
Yeah. has this game created any arguments ever? In your experience?
I mean, just good-natured ones of, I can't believe you pulled that. You know, I wish I could remember a specific swerve. I can't think of any right now that happened. But, you know, I can't believe you, you know, they'll say confidently, we know that word, and then it's no. It's like, oh, I can't believe you did that.
Yeah.
That kind of, you know, good-natured.
Right. Getting mad at your own team that they didn't see your very circuitous logic.
Yes.
I played this over Christmas with family. My husband's family, and David was on the opposite team, my husband, and I had his two brothers, and he's the baby. So I had his two brothers on my team, and we were getting them all right and high-fiving, and we all got it. And then on my husband's team was like three cousins that weren't as big of gamers. weren't going next level with it, and he was getting so frustrated. It was adorable, but we had
it was adorable from your perspective.
He was agonizing.
But every time his
he's
brothers
equally
would be
competitive
like,
as you.
You're going, absolutely. For sure. We game a lot, but his brothers would be like, "We crush you, David. You're getting destroyed. You suck." You know, I'm not a brother, but I assume that's what.
You tell him that at home.
Yeah, I do. And he handles it well for me. But coming from his brothers, it was personal. So that was a very funny memory. Because then, from then on, whenever we get one right, they'd be like, yeah. And I'd be like, shh. Tiny high five.
Yeah. I played this at a birthday party. And it was extraordinarily fun.
I see how...
Good story.
I was going to say who, but then it's like name dropping. I don't want to do that. So I'm like,
oh, gotcha.
Name drop it later.
Yeah, I'll tell you later.
Okay.
I see how it develops as the evening goes on, too, because not only the context of the games that you guys have played, but the in-jokes that happen that night and like what you've created in the magic circle that evening. It's such a great game that just builds.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It really does. And like the way you play this game the fifth time is... I find very different than what you play.
Sure. Yeah. Ugh, I'm eager to get this now.
Well.
It's good.
The magic circle abides. All right. Let's move on to Le Havre.
Yeah, I think maybe my favorite board game.
Can you describe how it's played?
Sure. Le Havre is a...
You don't pronounce the R?
It's French, so you can...
It's there. You can hear it.
You go Le Havre. Le Havre. But I don't do that very well. So it is a worker placement game, a game of resource management and building things. It takes place on the port town of Le Havre in France, and there's a ship that moves down a track that tells you what turn it is, and it's remarkably simple. There's very few things you can do on your turn. You can collect resources or you can build a building, and I love games where I can just create my little diorama world in front of me.
Sure.
I love the games where I'm like
tableau building.
I'm building my stuff, and I'm building buildings, and I'm sorry, I dropped my phone.
Oh, jeez.
I love that stuff. That like a personal game board, and you can build your thing. So this game allows for some of that. You build these buildings that give special powers. Other people can use your buildings, or you can use your buildings. So they open up new worker placement locations, and there's just a ton of resources to get because it's a game about a shipping town that has a bunch of resources. So you can turn resources into better resources. They like they you flip over the tiles and they become better, like clay becomes brick and stuff like that. And you build better stuff. You build giant ships and then you have to feed your people. So there's stuff.
It's
there's
a quintessential Euro game. Like it, it's kind of like the one like kind of I mean it's older it's like 2008
yeah it's a pretty old game by that, those standards but I find it to be in comparison to a lot of worker placement games really easy to teach
yeah
it's like you don't have that many things you can do on your turn and everything's very clearly laid out and there's only a few turns in the entire game so it's clear and the acquisition of stuff is really pleasurable. You talk about tactile. You have these piles of materials.
Yeah,
you get
that dopamine when you get that lumber.
So good.
Only a few turns. Can you do many, many actions within a single turn?
No, but it like in all Uwe Rosenberg games, it's like this ticking clock of like your people need to get fed in a couple of turns. Yeah. So what are you going to do? You got to build your engine, but also worry about feeding your people. So I don't know. I really, really love that game. It's super simple to teach, but there's lots of different things you can do, lots of levels of complexity.
Those best worker, the best worker placements games are the ones where to really just go to the place, do the thing. Because that's such a great gateway for people because the complexity can rise as the board gets bigger.
Yeah.
But the idea is still very easy to understand.
The best thing, the best way for me to describe why I love Le Havre is that on my turn, there are 20 things that I would love to do.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of worker placement games, it's like, it's all about reducing the number of things you can and being like, I can't do anything. You blocked me.
Wah,
Le Havre is like, no, you want to do all of it and you can, but you can only do one thing. So it feels like this abundance of riches of being like, oh, there's so much fish sitting there. I could take all that fish. That'd be great because my people need to eat. Oh, but you know what? Oh my gosh, that's an awesome building and I can build it right now. Oh, that'd be so cool too. It is just like all these cool things instead of feeling limited. It feels like you've got this, you just want to do everything.
Explosive.
Yeah.
Now we should mention, Uwe Rosenberg has made all the games. Let's see, some huge ones, Babel, that was 2000. Let's see, what's Agricola?
Agricola, classic.
Was discussed when Anna Cecilia came on this podcast. You guys talk about Agricola.
Yeah.
Caverna.
Caverna is maybe my number two game of all time.
Wow.
Yeah. It's like Caverna and Le Havre. I love him. I love his designs. But Caverna is like Agricola with quests, which is amazing. It's so good.
Amazing. Yeah. And he's just like, even if you haven't played these games, you've heard of these games because he's a big deal. The things he touches are turned to gold. A Feast for Odin is another one. And those are like the really, really well-known ones that, to mention, Patchwork is also a pretty well-known one. But he's everywhere, very prolific as a designer. So you are a fan of worker placement in Euro style.
Yes.
So you value mechanics over theme sometimes?
Oh, no. I would say there are definitely games I love for their... I guess that is a fair statement. I do prefer systems and learning systems over Ameritrash or, you know, the thing that's going to make me buy a game isn't that I get to live through the story of a zombie invasion. The thing that's going to get me to buy a game is that zombie invasion is done in a way that I've never played before.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So I guess that is accurate to say that I'm down for mechanics more.
It's just you picture the mechanics of an engine and just little cogs whirring in your brain.
Right.
I get it. Yeah, totally. What an amazing game. I'm very excited to play because worker placement gets done a lot, but when it's done well, it's done really well.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic mechanic, and it like having those decisions and being able to block other people and all that stuff is really fun.
Awesome. The other game that I wanted to talk a little bit about because you've played it recently and it looks beautiful. It was released last year, 2018. It's Everdell, and Starling Games put this out. And this is a really also worker placement.
Yeah.
But it's a three-dimensional board on a beautiful little tree with wood pieces.
Yeah.
Little meeples that look like squirrels and other forest critters.
Yeah. And there's like little berry meeples that are adorable and look like real berries.
Yeah. So do you want to explain a little more?
Sure. This is a game I kickstarted and have enjoyed. I don't know if I'd put it in my top whatever, but it's solid. It's fun. And it's beautiful. The art is stunning. And as you said, this three-dimensional board completely unnecessary. Like the three-dimensionality of it isn't necessary, but well it's said. Cool. It looks great on the
it
table.
It does look cool.
It is anthropomorphized critters that, again, you're building houses and structures and things, and then those houses and structures have on the card have a character. So there's characters and then there's places, and they have a character that you get for free if you build that thing. But you can also just hire other characters with berries and things. So it's a fun matching up of, oh, if I build this thing, I have this character in my hand. I can play him automatically. Oh, if I build this thing, I don't have that character. So maybe I should wait and not build this thing yet until try to get that character. That kind of fun efficiency.
Yeah, grabbing the bonuses kind of thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the cool thing about the art of this game, which is, as I said, beautiful, but all of the places have a picture of the character in them that is associated with them, and all of the characters have the place that they're associated with in the background of their art.
That's brilliant.
It's really well done.
When the art comes together, it really can make or break something. For me personally, I mean, you know, I love what we were just talking about the differences between Euro games and Ameritrash sort of games. I like it in the middle.
You
know, you've got to have the art that really makes me feel like I'm there and that it creates a world around that mechanic.
Yeah.
I love the design of this both procedurally and physically too. Like, it didn't have to be 3D, as you said, right? It'd probably be more technically efficient to not be.
Right.
Smaller
but
box.
You have to build this tree, and then of course the tree serves. The trunk is where the deck of cards goes.
Right.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, and there's
that's
cards that rest on the second level of the tree, which is cool. Yeah.
That's so good. I mean, like, we've knocked over decks before, and this just sits there so nicely.
It sure does. Now, I believe that you only need to get to 4 points to win this game. Strategy-wise, would you say it's one of those where because it's pretty quick, you do want to go for the quicker cash now instead of the engine, the card in front of you that will allow you to get things for free later on?
I don't know. This game, it's really wild. There's this notion of seasons. And you,
what is that? We live in Los Angeles.
I know, right? There's pilot season and there's earthquake season.
Don't forget fire season.
Fire season for sure. The wild thing about this game, the hardest thing to wrap my head around when I was playing Everdell is that you do something to trigger the turning of seasons individually. So I can still be in spring and you can be in summer.
Oh.
Which is weird.
That's not how seasons work.
I know.
We don't know. We don't know. We're just guessing.
Right. Thematically, it's a little odd, but in the game, it's interesting because if I hold back and I do more actions on my turn, you might actually go into the next season. And so we may be.
Is there a benefit for getting there first?
You get more workers when you move to another season. You get new things. So there's a lot of strategy in deciding like when I'm going to go to the next season, when I'm going to stop. And it's like basically like passing your turn and going to the next season. So that's really interesting. And there's not a lot to do at first, but you're setting yourself up because certain seasons trigger certain cards. So you're like, well, I want to get those cards out before I get to those seasons. So there's a lot of depth to it. It's a pretty interesting game, and I haven't won yet, so I'm the worst person to tell you.
Oh, okay. So now I see why it's not in the favorites list. See, you said that earlier.
Yeah, I crush it, Lahav.
That's a really interesting mechanic to have different players in different phases of the game.
Yeah,
I like that.
It's a little tricky to wrap your head around. When I was reading the rules, I was like, is that right? Because do I just sit around and wait for everybody to get to my season? No, you keep playing.
Yeah, you're
on
your
own. That season. You're playing. So
that's just the context of your rules.
Yeah.
What triggers game end? Someone getting to the end of their final season.
Yeah, everybody getting to the last season,
so
or all the cards
can complete
running out.
Their
I think.
Own?
What's that?
So if someone's racing ahead to winter, they don't end the game prematurely for everybody still in spring.
Right.
Oh.
Right, you still keep playing. They end it for themselves, yeah. But it tends to work out not that somebody's sitting around for 20 minutes waiting for everybody to finish, because as you move through the seasons, there's more to do. So it tends to be the kind of thing where you catch up and everybody. And it's all about how many workers you have. That's how many actions you get, as with every worker placement game.
Sure.
So you farther into the seasons, you get more workers, and things tend to
balance out. Sure.
But it's an interesting idea that I'd never seen.
Yeah, that's
before.
I don't think I've heard of anything like that before, which is great. Anytime you can put in a new mechanic that befuddles us, it's like,
so awesome.
Yeah, great. Let's try that. Yeah.
Love it. Okay, so it's not a Uwe Rosenberg.
No, I should know the name of the designer. I don't know it offhand.
Oh, I just meant like, where do you rank it? Honest review.
I mean, I think it's a lovely game. I do. I wouldn't say it's a must play or a must have. It is a very attractive game that I think makes a beautiful eye-catching thing on your table because of how it is three-dimensional and it's so pretty.
So many cards, too. There's lots of options.
It's really cool. I dig it. It's not, I mean, there's like, you know, 20 worker placement games I'd probably put ahead of it, but it's it's solid.
Got it. Yeah, if you love forests and critters, then this is the worker placement.
For sure, yeah.
And shout out to James A. Wilson, who was the designer on this one.
Cool.
All right. I want to hop back. Run on over, if you will, to Dungeon Run.
Yay!
Yeah, we've got more time. I want to talk about your show.
Thank you.
So, kind of, give me the elevator pitch of the world.
Well, it's Dungeons & Dragons, a live play Dungeons & Dragons show with an extraordinary cast of brilliant actors and a animatronic mind flayer as the host. And the thing that we do differently than everybody else, I think, is the audience interaction is a huge part of the show.
Right.
There's ways for the people watching live in the chat to communicate with the players. We introduced actually a thematic element in the game. The very first thing the players did when they got together was they went to this abandoned dragon's lair and they found this item that was trapped in crystal. And when they broke it out of the crystal, it was this amulet that actually allows them to communicate to the people watching the stream. We call them the Watchers of the Time stream.
What?
So they can actually ask it questions and the chat can answer it because it's all in real time on caffeine.
I want to be a Watcher of the Time stream. Yeah, that sounds so cool.
Tune in Wednesday night, 6 p.m. Pacific time, caffeine.tv/thedungeonrun.
There it is.
and it's really cool. And then there's like digital items that they can also purchase for the players if they so choose that grant the players advantage on rolls. Or there's these deck of cards, two decks, in fact, Force of Good and Force of Evil cards. And those are actually, I started writing them, but they have completely been taken over by the audience. The audience writes the cards and submits them. They're all user submitted at this point. And those are crazy. We call it chaos magic. So that when they flip over a Force of Good or Force of Evil, that thing happens in the game world to the players. Sometimes it grants them boons or abilities that they can do in combat. Sometimes we had 100 bunnies just pop out of the amulet in the middle of the store one time. Look, it's chaos magic. So there's lots of wacky, fun stuff. It also, an NPC's life was literally saved by a viewer interaction. I mean, it's really pretty cool and has opened up the show, I think, in a way that I did not anticipate, even as the DM. And I think it really separates us. But more than that, it's a great story with a bunch of really wonderful characters and a big adventure tale that we're trying to tell and I think doing a good job of. I say so myself.
That's incredible. Well, full disclosure, Jake Michaels, your wife Katie is a player.
She is. She plays a gnome, I should say, she plays a beach gnome bard named Lily Dumblestack.
What's a beach gnome?
Exactly.
Well, we invented it for the show. it is wonderful. It is. She comes from an island called Bingle, which is basically a resort town, a fantasy resort town. So it's like when adventurers go and fight dragons and stuff, they need to relax. They go to Bingle.
Absolutely.
And they get wonderful drinks and entertainment, and they relax and have a good time.
I'm wonderfully biased, of course, but like I love everything about that backstory that I've heard so far from her, and I'm just like so engaged in it because she's not a super experienced Dungeons & Dragons player, and I'm so in love with what she did. You both did, actually, because you guys crafted a lot of that backstory together.
Yeah, but she has taken it and run with it in a way that Katie is amazing, and the fact that she hasn't played a lot of Dungeons & Dragons, first of all, doesn't show, but second of all, I think is actually a huge benefit for the show because she approaches problems in such a novel, interesting way, and she has become the heart of the show.
Aww.
It is beautiful to see. The character she created, Lily Dumblestuck, is this wonderful, happy, positive bard who sings. She writes songs for the show. And two of the other characters, like, evidently are having some sort of love triangle now about her. It's really wonderful that it's all developing organically like that. But yeah, and this week, actually, we are going to Bingle. So that team is on a ship right now. We have this incredible. That's another thing I didn't even mention about the show is that we have these Hollywood prop masters who are building sets for us.
What?
And we have this incredible model of a full three-deck ship this pirate ship that we're on called the Tardy Plunder, and they're on their way to Bingal right now. So tonight,
will it be on time though?
Likely not. Not with the Tardy Plunder. But yeah, tonight we arrive in Bingal. But Bingal is a lot different than what Lily remembers. So yeah, it's gonna be funny fun.
I'm due for a Bingal.
Me too. Me too.
I want to go back to the forces of good and forces of evil, because DMing is a fair to say it's a hard thing. DMing on a live stream is an intense thing. DMing on a live stream where the audience can throw a curveball in it at their will,
yeah,
is nuts. And I think it takes a lot of bravery to do that, and you've handled it amazingly well. I mean, when you say what is happening on the show is that the audience can throw you those into you, it's like, how does that possibly work? And then you watch a show and it works wonderfully, because you guys have the idea of acceptance of the idea. Everybody's involved in it. They say, absolutely, this is happening. No one questions that the bunnies came out. Everybody's like, okay, how do we deal with it?
Right.
There's never a pause.
Right.
There's always, this is reality. And I love the magic circle that you've created, because they all accept that every time. Yeah. It's inspiring to watch.
Well, it's a credit to the players, and it is the idea that we came to this show very much agreeing that we're not playing a game so much as we're telling a story. And the game is there as a way to make that story happen, to facilitate the story. And so I look at it as a group improvisation exercise. We're all telling the story together, right? That's what D&D is.
Yes.
And those things are just new offers, new ideas that are being offered. Like, okay, now there's bunnies, 100 bunnies shot out. That's not something that you go, oh, that sucks. That's an opportunity to make something magical happen and cool and different, and something nobody walked into the stream today thinking we're gonna have to deal with 100 bunnies, but now we all are. And what does that mean?
Yeah.
So it opens the show up in ways that I think are interesting.
May I posit that you could just let the bunnies live? Did you let the bunnies live?
They were magical bunnies that only appeared for a short time, and they popped out of existence. But there was a lot of protecting of the bunnies. One of the characters, there was 100 of them, and one of the characters started throwing them out of the shop. They were in the shop at the time. Throwing them out of the shop, and as he was doing that, another character was naming them. You're fluffy. You're adorable. Whatever. She did a better job than I, but yes, it was wonderful.
Oh, wow.
It's an acceptance of the bad things, too, in a way that's so positive. I remember, I think it was Lily was struck with something where she had to attack 3 people next to her.
Yeah.
And she did the spell Vicious Mockery and insulted all of her friends who she just kind of only met a short time ago.
Yeah.
And had to do that.
It was a
bad roll on that spell?
No, great. Sometimes she hurt her friends. Vicious Mockery is you say an insult.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they take psychic damage from how painful it is.
So she also hit her friends in addition to the 3 enemies.
No. This was a card that forced her to attack her friends, right? This is a force of evil that came out that said, you have to attack your friends.
Oh, no.
And she's a bard. And so this is another example of Katie maybe not being tethered to, you know, established dogma of D&D, where she can look at that card and she goes, well, anybody else would say I'd take my dagger out and stab my friends, and you take, you know, 12 points of damage, whatever it is. And that's one way that it could have gone, and that would have been a bummer. But it wasn't as interesting as what she did, which she said, well, I have this spell called Vicious Mockery. Wouldn't it be more interesting if I just spew this series of profanities at my and insults at the team?
Absolutely.
And it was this, again, not taken as a game. In a game, you go, oh, I have to do X number of damage. I will do that damage. In a story, you go, I'm forced to do something painful to my friends. This is what my character would consider to be a painful thing that she would do to her friends. And that's what I think is so special about this group of players, is that they all think about the world like that. They're all role-playing. They often don't do the thing that's most advantageous, but they do the thing that makes the most sense for who their character is.
Absolutely.
And it like, I can't even begin to express how grateful I am for this group and how proud I am of the thing we're making because of that.
Oh, it sounds like such an incredible thing.
It is. I mean, I am not one to be boastful but honestly, I really am not. I tend to downplay the things I'm involved with. This show, I think, is the best thing I've ever done.
That's wonderful.
That is
professionally. I mean, I have two kids. They're great. Right. But like,
well, that
I
coming
honestly,
from you is a huge statement, and I'm sure that would mean a lot to the players. I'm sure you tell them because you're not one to hold back your thoughts
yeah.
either.
Yeah,
but
no, I really believe it.
What a wonderful compliment.
Yeah, it is a testament to them. It's a testament to the crew as well. I mean, we haven't the show is shot like a television show. A lot of D&D shows are shot like live streams, which is great, and I watch many of them. They're fantastic. Our show, we wanted to try to make it look like a TV show, and I think that team has pulled that off in an amazing way. And yeah, I'm super proud of it.
Did that come about as seeing what was out there in the field and saying, okay, we have to step up our game somehow, and how are we going to do that? Is that how a lot of these elements came about, of shooting it in the very cinematic style, having Hollywood production designers, having the interactive elements that are so unusual to specifically this show?
I don't know if it was a reaction to the other shows out there. I mean, I think, you know, Critical Role is phenomenal, and you know, kudos to all those folks. I love, and there are many, many others. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Adventure Zone and Acquisitions Inc. And there's the list goes on and on. Great, great, great stuff. So it wasn't like we were felt like we were competing or had to do certain things in response to that. But I know that Alex Albrecht, who created the show, he and I did the Totally Rad Show back in the day, and we met playing Dungeons and Dragons. That's how we met.
Oh.
And then I have DM'd for him in the past. And we, for years, before live streaming Dungeons and Dragons was a thing, we actually pitched the idea of doing a Dungeons and Dragons show. And we talked for a long time about how we would want to do it. And I think this is like his dream of, if you had the money, how would you do it? And this is the way he always wanted it to be done, like a television show with awesome sets and props, you know, done with audience interaction, but in a way that, you know, the audience talks to the puppet, right? The puppet hosts the show and he's in chat the whole time interacting with the audience. So the audience has this conduit, so they're not bothering me, the DM. I get fed that information from the puppet, the character of Lord Araban, this mind flayer. So there's a lot of really novel concepts that Alex came up with and we worked through. And so I don't think it necessarily was like we have to be different than anybody else, but this was like how we wanted to do this kind of show.
There's a great performance choice that you guys make too, in that with your audience interaction, which is supposed to be a very heavy concept of that show, you guys actually don't like technically as the players or performers engage with chat too much. You guys just acknowledge what they've done and thank them for it and then keep in the story. So the rhythm of the show keeps going.
We don't even see chat.
I know. And
that's what the character of Lord Araban, the puppet, is for.
Yeah, he's your ambassador.
He interacts with chat and he talks to them. So they have a constant interaction with the show. And then I wear an earpiece, and Lord Araban talks to me in my ear and says, the amulet, which is the audience, thinks this or wants this. So he edits that stuff and tells me the stuff that's most important from the chat. So I'm not constantly bombarded with it or distracted on my,
yeah,
like we were talking about before.
That can slow it all down. It's so great that it's so smooth and it's seamless. Honestly, I didn't know you wore an earpiece for a while. I thought that they were sending you messages and you had to read them a lot. And I was like, how is he keep going? And it's like, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. They have an earpiece in my ear and they'll be like, you know, the audience says this or the audience says that. And then sometimes I just don't incorporate that. And sometimes I do. Mm-hmm. So it's left up to me whether or not that stuff plays, but generally speaking, it's an opportunity. And I go, oh, awesome. The audience has a great idea that we didn't think of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the beautiful thing about what interactive media has given us, is the ability to have a billion minds, well, you know, thousands of minds collaborating on an idea simultaneously.
Yeah.
Just such a cool thing. I mean, six minds can come up with amazing stuff.
Right.
But 2,000.
Sure. Yeah.
Blows the roof off. All right. Well, Jeff Cannata, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Thank you.
Speak to you. People can watch The Dungeon Run Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Pacific at caffeine.tv/The Dungeon Run.
Mm-hmm. Also on YouTube or as an audio podcast, wherever you get podcasts.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to shout out?
DLC is at 5by5.tv/DLC and /filmcast is at /filmcast.com. And I'm on Twitter at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T.
Ooh, smooth.
Exactly the way it should be.
Yeah, I think so.
And if you want to see the new talkback show that's about The Dungeon Run, it's on Tuesday nights on caffeine.tv twitch.tv/thedungeonrun at 6 o'clock right now.
Yeah, we did that last night for the first time. It was a blast. And I think they're gonna be on YouTube as well, right?
Yes, they are, as a matter of fact. And you were wonderful. It's a great insight into things. And I was watching chat very actively in that, and they were all like, this is great.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun to talk about the world we're creating and all the
It was good to get behind the screen. Happen, yeah. Stuff. I was very excited about the moment that you got up out of your chair and ran to go get the map. We were like, what's going on? This is great.
Well, and how wonderfully convenient to serve up a summary the night before the show every week.
Yeah, exactly.
So make sure you tune in this week to the Dungeon Run. Thanks so much for listening to Victory Points. I'm Becca Scott. That's Jake Michaels.
Hi. Bye.
And we'll see you guys next time. Take care. Make sure that you subscribe and like and share and rate this podcast. Okay. Bye.
See ya.